directly to that part of me that ached for belonging. And that was enough. In fact, it was everything. And I've learned that strange people find each other by accident, on purpose, sometimes through static. I've learned that sounds like what is a mistake is often the start of something real. You can lose your voice, you can lose your notes, you can lose your train of thought, and still find your frequency, literally and metaphorically. Heck, I've learned that creaking frogs are a genre. I've learned that sounding like yourself might be the most serious thing that you can do. Because we're trained to sound like someone else, like a talking head, or like an expert, or like a commercial for insurance. But it's that cracking, nervous, and deeply weird voice that's the one that we're waiting for. I believe that a playlist can be a prayer, and that a voice on the dial can be a lifeline. Silence on the air can be a sign of respect. And like you, I've broadcast with broken headphones, a sticky board, and one working pen that smells like the swamp. See, you know what I'm talking about. And when the tech breaks, which you all know that it will, you find out who you really are. Chances are it's not the smooth one. It's not the clear signal. It's the distortion, the interference, but also the clear channel. Grassroots, community. We're strange. And that's the art of it. These are strange times. There's no doubt about it. You feel it in your bones when you do the news rundown. Every time you air content that sparks curiosity. Every time you choose joy in a world that's asking you to be ordinary. Strange times need strange voices. Voices with texture, voices with accents, voices with pauses, ideas with dirt under your nails, stories told out of order, and genres that clash and spill over. Disrupted times need disruptive formats. Frogs on the airwaves. Mistakes. Playlists that no algorithm will ever recommend. And I know weirdness can make us uncomfortable, but discomfort isn't a failure. I believe that it's a signal. It means that something alive is trying to break through. Strangeness isn't the enemy of truth. It's the way that truth sneaks in sideways. It says, you don't have to sound like me, and please don't sound like me. Just sound like you. Because in the end, it's not the content, it's the contact. It's not the reach, it's the resonance. It's not the polish, it's the possibility. So if I can offer you anything tonight, after all this, with my head absolutely exploding with like oh my God. It's this. Keep being strange. Take that permission slip to the end of the world. Let your show be too much. Let your voice shake. Let your playlist get so weird. So weird. Let the silence stretch for longer than you know it should. Let the stranger in. Because they're you. They're us. They're why we built this signal in the first place. So may your weird be welcome. May your frequency stay just a little fuzzy. May you make space for what makes no sense, but feels absolutely right in your bones. May you never sound like another. And may your mistakes become the most beloved part of the archive. Because strange times, they don't just tolerate strangeness, they demand it. Thank you. I'll be listening.
Long-standing ovation for Robin Erickson at the 2025 Crabbo Awards, Community Radio Awards for Broadcasting and Online in Nanaimo 12 days ago already. Wow. if you have been listening to CJSF for the last decade, you have heard Robin's fingerprints all over every show and every airwave in her steadfast support of people doing the crazy, weird, interesting, strange things that they want to do here at CJSF. And if you're inspired by that, you're welcome to join us. We are a volunteer-run organization that is open to members of the community, students at SFU, people who live in the surrounding cities, anyone who wants to get involved and be a little strange. So I really encourage you to do that. By coming by the station, we're in room 1420 of the Student Union Building in the basement. Or you can just send an email to our volunteer coordinator at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca. That's V-O-L, the number 4, CJSF at sfu.ca. Or you can get in touch with me directly at CJSFPROG, as in programming, prog, CJSF prog, at sfu.ca. Yeah. Okay. Let's hear a little bit more music and then we'll get back to the talk. This is The Houseplants.
Thank you.
Falling by the Houseplants. And now we're going to head to Senya's interview with Richard Frank, a researcher here at Simon Fraser University, about cybercrime and the dark crawler and some other stuff he's worked on.
So my name is Richard Frank. I'm a professor here in the School of Criminology, and all of my research and my classes and students, everything focuses on computer crime.
Can you explain the concept of principal component analysis and how it is applied to identify key nodes in networks associated with child exploitation?
The general approach, so I'm assuming you took these questions out of one of the papers.
Yeah.
The idea of the paper was to incorporate the amount of images and content on the network as opposed to just their position in the network. And also to see which nodes are the most important in terms of if you remove them, you disconnect the network. So that's where the principal component analysis would come in, is it would help us find the nodes which are important, and if you were to remove them, would splinter the network into as many pieces as possible. Mm. So the idea is you're browsing around on this content, child exploitation content, you find one website, you browse around, it has links to some other websites, you click on it, so you visit some other and some other. If you were to, you as the attacker or police, if you can remove some of these websites, then that browsing won't be possible because you won't be able to reach as far away. You would encounter broken links, that sort of thing, make the content harder to discover.
Okay. What advantages do these PCA algorithms offer over traditional attack methods like hubs, bridges, and network capital?
It's a different approach. You could argue hubs are important. We argue that splintering the network would yield the biggest benefit in terms of disrupting the network.
Hmm. And in what ways did PCA underscore A and PCA underscore L prove more effective than established attack methods in targeting child exploitation networks?
So typically, for example, police would go after the websites or websites that contain a lot of content, mm-hmm. which is important. We were looking at how to disrupt the network. So so someone visiting and looking for this content would have a very difficult time in finding new websites and new places for this content. So these two matrices would help in terms of disrupting that discovery of new content.
And could the success of these algorithms be replicated in networks outside of child exploitation, such as drug trafficking or human smuggling?
The approach is not dependent on this being a child exploitation network. Any network where the goal is you want to disrupt and segregate the network into as many splinter components as possible, mm-hmm. would have the same benefit.
Okay. And the study suggests that PCAL was particularly effective in isolating critical nodes. Could you elaborate on the structural significance of these nodes?
I would need to have a look at the paper. Mm-hmm. If I recall correctly, isolates those components or those nodes, websites that are completely isolated after you remove some of the websites that we target. Those would be impossible to discover, essentially,
mm-hmm.
Which was one of the goals of the method that we're proposing.
And how might law enforcement agencies leverage this insight to disrupt online child exploitation networks?
So their goal has been to remove high-profile targets, which is great. But those don't necessarily live in isolation. There might be other websites that draw visitors to that, which might be more important. You could cause more damage to the entire ecosystem if you removed websites that drive traffic to your current target. So it's a different way of prioritizing.
And are there any potential legal or ethical concerns when deploying these algorithms in sensitive investigations?
When we started this project, the first thing we did was we talked to the Integrated Child Exploitation Unit of the RCMP here in, well, it was in Surrey, because we didn't want to get into legal trouble. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to be arrested and for accessing this type of content. But instead of them, well, they told us some guidelines, but instead of them discouraging the entire research, they actively encouraged it. One of the exceptions to our child exploitation laws here in Canada is for academic purposes. So mm-hmm. we as researchers, for research purposes, can access this. The crawler that we used was developed so that humans will need to look at this content. Mm-hmm. And the police gave us a hash database, or like a fingerprint of images. So if we encountered an image, we could fingerprint it, compare it to their database, and without looking at it, determine if it's child exploitation content.
And with the dark crawler, it was used to gather over 150 million posts related to violent extremist activities. What were some of the key findings from this data collection?
Data set has been used for many different studies, not just right-wing, but also incel-based research. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that we've looked at were trying to identify the same ideas for the child exploitation content, trying to target, like identify the best targets. Police would have a limited amount of resources. Targeting becomes really, really essential. So the idea was, if we can have a look at the entire community, can we identify people who are driving the narrative, who are radicalizing other people, for example. Mm-hmm. And if we can isolate people who are driving the topic, go after them. Those would be good targets. Alternatively, you could also go after people who are being radicalized. Let's say 2 years ago someone joined, then they started asking questions, very benign stuff, and then a year after they started interacting with someone else, and then all of a sudden their conversations had become more extreme. And the more extreme and more extreme, is that person approaching sort of like an acting out phase, mm-hmm. in which case they could be physically violent, and those might be good targets. Hmm. So that's roughly where the research that we worked on was.
Wow. And how does the data collected by the dark crawler inform our understanding of the communication strategies used by extremist networks?
A couple of different ways. For right wing, the communication seems to be somewhat benign, meaning they know, they're fully aware of the language that will get them into trouble, mm-hmm. and they stay away from it. Mm-hmm. So picking up on these nuanced things tends to be quite difficult, because they know they're not supposed to talk about certain things, so they don't. In another community, the incel community, the involuntary celibates, they have specific code words which they use, and upon first reading, you probably won't know what those code words are and won't fully understand what the discussion is about.
I might actually looked into incels a bit.
Once you pick up the terminology, it's not that difficult. But once you pick up on the terminology, the conversation becomes much more obvious of mm-hmm. what they're talking about, and all the negativity and how they perceive women and a certain segment of the male population. But you need to build a code book, sort of either an actual document or in your mind, to be able to understand it. Does that answer the question?
With the incels, like, what were some of the like communication methods you managed to find with the dark crawler?
We would analyze the sentiment that they're talking about, the topics they're talking about. One of the other important things or topics in these communities is how they individuals can be de-escalated or de-radicalized. And one thing that we found was that any, especially in the ASL community, any attempts at de-radicalization would very quickly get you kicked out. So they reject that content quite actively, which makes it very difficult to for whatever researchers, government, law enforcement, whatever, to go in and try to de-radicalize certain people. Mm-hmm. How they leave the community becomes very important, because you want to draw people out of the community to make sure they're healthy.
And I'm assuming some of the communications you might have managed to find is like the code words that I know incels use is Chad's, Stacy's.
Yeah, those.
Yeah, those ones. Taking the red pill or the black pill, like those ones too.
Yes.
Is that what you guys managed to find?
We have an entire document with like 40 keywords on it or more. It's been a while since I've seen it, so it might be expanding. Yeah, they have their own terminology for these things.
Considering with the vast data set collected by the Darkcrawler, what challenges arise in terms of data privacy and ethical considerations?
So for ethics, we for all the projects that we've done, we've gone through the ethics board. The line is relatively clear. We don't go after personal details. That is a privacy thing. It's an ethical thing. And we don't actually care about private details. We are looking at the aggregate. What is this community doing? Not what is whatever John Doe doing in that community. So the privacy has been pretty clear. We don't collect private details. We're, again, looking at the aggregate in the entire community.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what content we collect, we are able to collect anything that does not require any interaction. So we don't engage with the community. And also, we don't use our personal details to log in, for example, to a website. So anything that requires that would be out of bounds, mm-hmm. off limits. Having said that, we've done studies on crypto markets where they sell drugs.
Mm.
And those do require logins, but the logins are a made-up username and password. So not tied to an email address or not tied to any personal details. And that has been okay to collect.
And how do researchers balance the need for comprehensive data collection with the potential for infringing on individual rights?
There are lots of studies that talk to individuals. We don't do that. We do talk to individuals, but the focus is on the entire community. We don't ever act as an arm of law enforcement or government, for example. We haven't done anything and don't intend to do anything at the request of police, for example.
Mm.
These are all academic research questions that we try to answer. We make sure that we don't violate anyone's privacy in the process.
And what measures are in place to prevent misuse of data obtained through such large-scale network analysis tools?
The data that we collect sits in IP services on a SFU managed machine. It's accessible through a website that's password protected. A couple of my researchers and my criminology class has access to, because I asked them to look at some of that content and analyze it for some of their course projects. The access they have, they have access to the entire data, but they can't siphon the data off the system.
Mm-hmm.
So they could read some of the content, but they can't mass download the entire database. Even if that were possible, the data that it would get would still essentially be a copy of what's freely available in some of these forms. I know the data could be misused to, people collect social media content all the time and do facial profiling on them, and et cetera. We don't collect any images, we just collect the text.
Mm-hmm. And to close off, final question, with the Darkcrawler, which type of incels did you guys manage to find information on? Like, do you guys have, like, their names and, like, what they do? And, like, did you guys, like, look into any other incels or, like, study more infamous incels?
We don't try to break anonymity. Mm-hmm. So if username Bob57 is online, we don't try to identify that person as to whether they're in Canada or Washington or whatever. So we don't. The goal is not to identify and put a name to that user. Again, the focus would be more on how does the community behave, what language do they use, how do they perceive whatever topic, and understand those things. There have been a couple of incels that have gone off and murdered people. We do know their usernames, so we can retroactively go back and see, are there any hints as to why this person acted out? Or is there discussion before acting out different than everyone else in that community? And if so, how is it different? Meaning, can we differentiate certain people that are likely to act out? So that would be one question. But even if we found an incel murder some people, has a specific type of conversation online, and there are a couple of other people that are conversing in the same fashion, we wouldn't be going after their anonymity. It's not, we can't be the arm of law enforcement.
And would you consider, like, incels to be, like, a relatively new threat? Or, like, how big of a threat do they pose to society in general?
In terms of the idea itself, I don't think it's a new idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ability to connect to like-minded people, thanks to the internet, has made this community be a recognized community. People suddenly found others who are like-minded and then became encouraged by them.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, I'm not weird, quote unquote. There are other people that think exactly like I do, so I'm going to talk to them. The problem is then other perspectives get closed off and they start to be radicalized and radicalized. But it's not, the idea I don't think is a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of whether they pose a threat or not, it's difficult to say if a person is in the community and then gets radicalized and poses a threat, or whether they will eventually pose a threat and that's why they're in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So they too could be, and like we are, correlated, but we don't know which causes which. Whether they act out and that's why they're in the thing, or they're in the thing and that's why they act out. So I don't know how dangerous that community is. Looking at the past, yes, they have gone off and murdered people. At the same time, there are other communities that are much more violent. So I would say those are bigger threats.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks to Tsenya and to Richard Frank for that interview. Coming up right away, right now, is Democracy Now. I'm Jess.